Welcome back to Fontanelle, and today we're looking at abdominal migraine in the second of a two-part series on abdominal pain in children. I'm joined today by Dr. Charlie Powell, a GP with a special interest in paediatrics, who's been key in setting up primary care paediatric clinics across East Dorset. Charlie's going to tell us all about abdominal migraine as well as the other conditions under the umbrella term of the periodic syndromes. He'll tell us key things to look for in the history as well as explaining the fascinating mechanism behind these conditions. And that's really important because that enables us to explain to parents and children how they can treat this disease using food. So, for example, by avoiding chocolate, citrus fruits, Marmite and cheese, you can actually really reduce your symptoms or sometimes resolve the condition entirely. That's because these foods contain vasoactive amines, which affect blood flow through the body. So I'm very happy today to be welcoming Charlie Powell onto the show. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you.
Great to meet you and really great to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks very much.
And today we're going to be talking about, a subtype of abdominal pain.
Yes, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, one of the groups that falls into the functional abdominal pain is the illness known as abdominal migraine. But that sits in its own little small group with abdominal migraine, cyclical vomiting syndrome and benign paroxysmal vertigo, which together collectively are called the periodic syndromes. And abdominal migraine in particular has been one of the things that comes quite frequently to the primary care paediatric clinics. And I quite enjoy trying to establish it as a diagnosis because I think it's a fun thing to spot and to work with. And I think as physicians we can be really effective at trying to settle the symptoms down because it's very debilitating for the children who suffer with it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm glad you think it's fun. I find the diagnosis mildly terrifying because I don't really know what it is. So can you just explain?
It's an interesting one. The exact mechanism doesn't seem to be known, although there's a lot of work which gives indications as to what might be causing it. It's thought to be pretty prevalent. Most of the studies suggest that the prevalence is at least 2-4% of children, but some of the studies show that the peak incidence at around the 11-12 year old age can be as high as 9%, was one study in the States, which is stating that it's really a very, very high prevalence, because that would be looking at almost as many as kind of two or so children in every class. The mechanism, it's I think called migraine because it fits well with the kind of general diagnosis of migraine that's seen in the whole population. And one factor about abdominal migraine and the associated conditions is there is a strong link with adult migraine. So the studies generally show that in the children in whom we diagnose this, probably at least two-thirds will have a parent who is suffering with adult migraine. And it does seem that the children who struggle with this have an increased incidence, and the studies show that probably similarly, maybe about half might go on to get adult migraine themselves.
So how does it tend to present?
The presentation, it can present from 2-3 years of age. More commonly, the main presentation tends to be in the 6-12 year old age range. And the classic presentation is a child who fundamentally is well, but gets episodes where they will usually describe a central abdominal pain. It's normally periumbilical, slightly non-specific in nature, which can last for different periods of time. Sometimes it's the order of 20-30 minutes or an hour or two, but in some children can drag on for 2 or 3 days. The literature quotes anywhere between 2 and 72 hours. The pain always is central, and if you get a pain that's consistently right-sided or left-sided, that generally isn't going to be abdominal migraine. That's going to be something pathological rather than functional. The commonest other description is that children look very pale, and the usual description is of a child that gets slightly subdued, slightly withdrawn. Usually they look fairly pale, and then they get a central cramping abdominal pain. And that can be quite debilitating. Some children can end up in casualty, and I've known children where appendicitis has been suspected, or they've been given Oramorph because people were worried about the intensity of the pain. What you also notice is that they can also demonstrate some of the other symptoms which verge more into cyclical vomiting. So they often will describe feeling nauseated, sometimes actually being sick. And if that becomes a very predominant symptom, then that merges more into the category of cyclical vomiting syndrome. But what you generally won't get described is that you won't have associated change in bowel pattern, change in urinary symptoms, skin rashes, or other types of descriptors like that. And then the really critical thing with the diagnosis is in between the episodes, the child is completely well. And the overall picture is this is a child who is thriving, weight is stable, gaining, developmentally normal. So all of the other aspects about the child are of a healthy, thriving child that's progressing well. And these intermittent episodes come and go. And when the episode's finished, the child is perfectly well, often within minutes afterwards, and is back on eating, drinking, and off and away.
And while they've got the symptoms, they're not eating and drinking, is that
no,
because they're nauseous and just
often the children, as with all kind of migraine sufferers, usually want to go away somewhere fairly quiet, darkened room, often lay down and just kind of sleep off or see out the symptoms.
And is it associated with a headache as well, or does that not really come into it?
It can be present, but it's not, it's in the kind of minority. The majority, it tends to be the central cramping periumbilical pain. Some will describe a headache. More commonly, it tends to be the tendency to nausea and an occasional vomit. And then its kind of cousin or bedfellow, as it were, is cyclical vomiting syndrome, and that is characterized by the same initial symptoms coming on, but then it quite rapidly progresses through to the vomiting phase. And vomiting can be over a number of hours, but sometimes again can go on for days. And in the severe form of cyclical vomiting syndrome, that's problematic because you start to get the metabolic consequences of repeated vomiting. So that occasionally can require children to be admitted. The benign paroxysmal vertigo, where children will describe dizziness and some can describe the true vertigo, these episodes can come sometimes with the other symptoms as well, sometimes on their own. They are periodic, come and go. But what's interesting is all of the three conditions tend to respond quite well to the same fundamentals of treatment. So they seem to be kind of interlinked in that way.
So we'll talk about treatment in a second. What would you expect to find on examination? Would that be normal essentially as well?
When examining a child, 99.99% of the time when they present, they're going to be in between episodes. So your examination should be absolutely completely normal. Sometimes the children will describe a kind of non-specific periumbilical tenderness. But generally speaking, you're expecting to find a child that looks completely healthy, and everything about them is healthy. You know, they're bright, they're alert, they're active, they're charging around the kind of consultation room. If you're finding lots of abnormal signs, or a child that's looking unwell, then that doesn't fit with the pattern of abdominal migraine.
And if you are looking at them during an episode, would they...
During an episode, that's where it gets difficult, because they will appear unwell. They will be pale, they will be cramped over, they'll be nauseated, they might be being sick. If a child has been sick repeatedly, then you're starting to get all of the metabolic consequences of that. So you're starting to develop the signs of metabolic alkalosis. So that's what can end up with children becoming dehydrated and being admitted to hospital. So in the midst of an episode, it can be hugely difficult to untangle what's going on with that child at the time. So you can see when children like this pitch up to casualty, without the knowledge that these episodes have been frequent over a long period of time, it's so tricky because the poor doctors are thinking of every different differential diagnosis. So this is a much, much easier diagnosis to be taking in outpatients with a well child sitting in front of you when you've got a nice careful history of something that's been going on for 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, 3 years, and you can spot the repeated pattern. So it's almost a history of the pattern that fits with it in a child who otherwise is thriving and healthy. Now in the middle of an episode, I think it's really tough, because you're presented with what appears to be an unwell child in pain, and the differential for that can be very wide.
Okay, so say you're talking to a patient and parents, how would you go about explaining this, what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think once you kind of assess and examine and you're comfortable that you think, right, this is the diagnosis and everything fits, the way I try and explain it to parents is I firstly explain that the vascular system and our circulation is a bit more complex than people first imagine. So people imagine the heart pumps the blood out, veins bring it back, and blood just circulates. But I then go on to explain that our body has got lots of mechanisms which are shifting blood about the body. So if you jump into a sauna, the blood's all going to your skin. If you run outside in the cold weather, it shifts centrally. If you start jogging, the blood all shifts to your muscles, and you shift blood to your guts and to your liver after you've eaten a meal. And our body is doing this the whole time, dependent upon temperature, exercise, how we're eating, and also position and lots of other factors. And there's a lot of involvement of the brain in that, what they call the kind of brain-gut axis. And there are chemicals, neurochemicals, which are controlling these things. With migraine, that mechanism seems to get upset. So often an easy way for parents to understand it is to think of what would be a classical adult migraine. So if you initially get changes where the vascularity seems to be closing down, they can often understand the early parts of a migraine where your vision starts to close in, you get disturbed visual phenomena, and then you get almost like the rebound effect where the thumping headache comes, where the vascular flow seems to be restored. And in children, the same type of thing is going on in the gut. So it's partly evident in that you can see a child going quite pale. And these changes are what seems to be causing the symptoms to arise in the gut. And that also can be reflected sometimes with the headaches as well. Then I kind of, in terms of the food triggers, to try to get the parents to understand that link, I often take the example of something like caffeine, and to explain to parents that there are certain things in certain foods and drink which affect that system in the body. So if, for example, we think of the chemical caffeine in tea and coffee, if you and I were to drink one cup of coffee, chances are we would be fine, we wouldn't notice much. But if we were made to drink 10 cups of coffee, all of a sudden we would all be starting to note a slight reaction, in that our heart rate would be going a bit faster, we'd be flushing a little bit, might be feeling a little bit unsettled. And if you had a tendency to migraine, chances are your symptoms would be potentially being triggered by that, and being and that might be precipitating the symptoms. But then the explanation moves on that there are other chemicals in other foods which act in a similar way. So you get the same types of chemicals which are in cheeses, yogurts, chocolate, citrus fruits, particularly things like Marmite and yeast extracts and certain E-numbers can work in the same way. So try to build up this picture that if someone were drinking 10 cups of coffee day in, day out and getting a lot of symptoms, actually reducing that down is a good way of trying to control the symptoms. So if you then look at the kind of global context of their diet, and it generally isn't going to be the caffeine, but it's going to be the chocolate, the cheese, the yogurts, the citrus fruit, the Marmite, the E-numbers, and I give them a kind of leaflet which has the things which contain these elements which are broadly known as vasoactive amines, if we can reduce those down in the diet, it's effectively like taking that person who was drinking 10 cups of coffee every day and reducing them back down to drinking one cup of coffee each day. Explaining to them that it's not allergy. Allergy works in a different way, but it's just an overload which seems to trigger these symptoms. And it's difficult to find the clinical evidence that absolutely supports this because there aren't huge numbers of trials. But in practical terms, it seems that a lot of these children, if they are having a lot of these triggers day in, day out, if you can reduce it back, many of them do tend to kind of respond. And I've had a few children where they've noticed really particular triggers which were specific to them that caused a lot of trouble. I had one little boy I remember who was, his school attendance was down to about 63-64%, and we worked out he was having a Marmite sandwich every single day. And he stopped that and it completely disappeared. And he'd been struggling for a couple of years with this. So that was a very strong trigger for him. So before moving on to any kind of medications, we tend to look at these kind of general factors, food triggers that they might be having regularly in kind of excessive quantities, and say, well, aim to try not to have these things every single day, but just use them in kind of relatively small amounts. And also the kind of late nights, too much TV, too much kind of loud noise, all of the kind of triggers which just fatigue children, to try and help. So trying to move in with a conservative approach and see if you can settle it down that way.
Wow, that makes total sense. Do they go for that explanation?
Yeah, I think in our clinics, what's kind of really fab is that we've got a kind of 25 minute slot. So it gives us an ability to kind of try and explain how this all seems to kind of link together. And when you look at the research work, it's interesting because it doesn't seem to be just changes in blood flow, but it seems to be something to do with the kind of brain gut axis and the kind of chemical factors. And there's something in amongst all of that which appears to underpin migraine. And certainly these triggers just seem to make it all a lot worse.
And is there, if it is to do with the gut-brain axis sort of being misaligned somehow, is there any way this can be reset by removing these triggers and that somehow later on they'd be able to reintroduce them, or is it just a tendency that person has because that's how they're made?
Yeah, my understanding is I think it's there, it's a tendency that they have. In it seems to be that in families where migraine is always present in the family history, that this cohort of patients seem to be the one where these triggers play a part. So it's quite common that if you have a child that fits the categories, often you'll find more often the mum or the grandmum tends to kind of have a family history for adult migraine. It's thought, it seems to be the kind of papers suggest that it's slightly more common female to male. I think it's about 1.6 female to one male. So it's a touch more common in girls and women. But there does seem to be this kind of strong family history. So whether there's some genetic predisposition, I think the research work looks at that, but I don't think anything is validated just yet.
And if you're asking then a child to change their eating habits and say remove some of these triggers, do you get to keep a food diary or a diary of their sleep? And
one can come back
and review later, or how do you follow all this?
Yeah, what I would say is if you can get the kind of parents on board, what I normally have an approach is to say, well, why don't we for 6 to 8 weeks try to reduce these things back as much as is practicable, and see initially whether that will calm the symptoms down. And then if that does work, that seems to imprint upon the parents that there is this link and we're actually kind of going in the right direction. And then when you kind of meet up, if that has been a successful approach, you can then say, well, what you could do is loosen the reins a little bit, start to have a few of these things and see whether the symptoms come back. And that allows them to see whether specific foods seem to be the trigger for that child. And also it seems to show them a balance of how much these things they can have without it being too much to kind of set off all of their symptoms. If when they kind of come back, having tried all of the conservative approaches, if the child is reportedly no better at all, then number one, I always kind of go back to first base and think, right, did I assess this child correctly? Are we on the right lines here? If I think it does still fit with the condition, then that's when you would potentially move on to trialing the medications if the parents, you know, wanted to go that way.
Okay, so what would those medications be?
The two commonest that I've tended to use are pazotafen and propranolol. The pazotafen, there seems to be some clinical evidence for that. They've done some trials and it seems to have an effect above placebo. There are four or five other different medicines which can be used. None of them particularly have been trialled, I don't think, but they're just used in terms of regular practice. So pazotafen can be used, or propranolol. Pazotafen seems pretty effective. The downside is it's slightly sedating, but you give it before going to bed, and it does seem to be a stimulant for appetite. So if you have a child that's struggling with obesity, then that may not be the one. Propranolol is generally a BD dose that's in the BNF, and tends to be around the order of something like 20 milligrams twice a day. Obviously, for those children, you have to ensure that they're not asthmatic. So you can go for either of those depending upon the other factors within a child. And we would usually aim to, again, go for maybe a kind of 6 to 8 week course and then review the child and see how things have progressed. That can fit really well if it's an abdominal migraine and the symptoms are very prevalent, and over that space of time you get a good answer whether something's working or not. What can be a little bit more tricky is if you have a child that's got something like cyclical vomiting syndrome, but the episodes come once every 8 weeks, then it's more difficult because an approach with prophylaxis becomes less easy to sell if the episodes are much further apart. So I think there's a judgment call as to how you're going to approach treatment.
So in that case, if it is cyclical vomiting and you're reluctant then to start one of these prophylactic treatments, do you then sort of prescribe something which can be taken as an episode is felt to be starting?
Yeah, I think it's probably individual to each child. The family have tried all of the conservative measures and they can't get things settled down, if when the episodes come, if they are really severe and they're causing missed days from school or hospital admissions, then, you know, you may be justified to say, well, let's try, you know, pazotafen, propranolol or other of the medicines, because you kind of think, well, the benefits are going to outweigh the fact that we're taking a dose each day. There are other medicines which are used as acute medicines. In the older children, you can start to use the triptans, and they have a place once children are in a slightly older cohort. So that can be a useful way of using it. I know with cyclical vomiting in the more severe cases, sometimes using things like ondansetron as a kind of early treatment has also played a part as well. The as soon as you're getting to the kind of more problematic, more complex children, that tends to end up more in secondary care with help from the consultants.
Mm. And the benign paroxysmal vertigo also responds to the same medications?
Seems to, because I think the thought is that this is part of the same group of conditions. Most of the children I've seen who've had this, they also had a touch of abdominal migraine as well. Mm-hmm. And you almost get the two symptoms either occurring together or episodes which are slightly more one, slightly more the other. And the same types of approaches seem to be effective in kind of calming it down.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that you would expect would be with them for their life?
Yeah,
but they just learn to manage it and learn to avoid these foods for the rest of their life.
It's interesting. It does appear that the condition ultimately settles or they grow out of it, however you would want to term it. I think when I was reading one study, it was saying that if you looked at that cohort of children between 10 and 12, which is the kind of peak incidence, about 85% within 2 years, it's all settled down. And it does seem to be much less common going into the mid to late teens. And it seems to be this is very much a condition that seems to come peak maybe at 10, 12, 13, and then kind of fade away. Mm-hmm. So it's usually managing it for over a couple of years, and then it seems to fall back. We know that you can diagnose abdominal migraine in some adults. It's less common. So there's obviously a small group who are still getting problems going into adulthood. The biggest link with this condition appears to be that as this fades and those children move into adulthood, they've got increased risks of getting more classical adult type migraine.
Yeah. Great. Are there any complications to it other than sort of days off school and just generally not feeling well?
Yes, I mean, it tends to be missed days off school. One big problem that we've had is that whenever a child vomits, the schools often like to implement the 48-hour rule
because they
think it's infective. Mm. So I often will copy my clinic letter to the parents so that they can discuss it with school, because with a child like this, once they've actually become unwell, they're fine to be back in school half an hour later. Mm. You know, they don't need to miss the whole rest of the day or the next day. So that can be one problem, kind of trying to liaise with school around that. The other things is, I think if the pains continue and it isn't seen for what it is, it creates an awful lot of anxiety in the families, and that seems to just fuel it. Because if the parents think there is something pathological going on, then their anxiety levels go up and up and up and up. And also, I think if it's not recognized for what it is and settled down, children get investigated and sometimes over investigated, because people start doing lots of bloods and scans and all sorts of other investigations, and I suspect the odd child here and there has had laparotomies thinking that it's an appendix. So I think there are those type of knock-on problems. But in general terms, it's kind of missed days from school, trips into casualty, and a lot of kind of parental anxiety for children.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work been done about the link with mental health issues, and do children have an increased chance of anxiety, depression? It's difficult. Some of the papers seem to suggest that you have got a slightly increased chance of those symptoms developing, but the caveat they put on that is often the prodromal symptoms that you get are that children feel quite down, quite low, almost what you'd think of as a bit depressed, while the kind of condition, while each episode is developing, and whether that gets slightly mislabeled as anxiety, depression. So it's tricky to untangle that, I think.
Okay, is there anything else you think we should mention?
There's some very good resources that are available. So for cyclical vomiting syndrome, there's a national society. So if people Google it, I believe it's CVSA UK, and that's got some very good information about the condition, the research that's being done on the condition, and also there are support groups which are set up around the country, so that can be kind of quite useful. Mm-hmm. For abdominal migraine, as I say, I enjoy looking after it because the kind of good majority of these children, you can actually really change things around and get them happy and pain-free, or the episodes coming far less frequently and just not disturbing their schooling and their life.
Mm, that's brilliant. Great. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Yeah, no problem at all.
Thank you once again so much to Charlie Powell for telling us all about abdominal migraine and the associated conditions. I think what Charlie does so nicely is highlight what to ask in the history. So if we've got an 8 to 10 year old child who's perhaps missing quite a bit of school, who's got recurrent abdominal pain, which is central, which is associated with pallor, and perhaps the child's quite withdrawn beforehand. If there are no associated bowel or urinary symptoms, no rashes or other red flags, then we really should be thinking about the diagnosis of abdominal migraine. I think the fact that the examination is entirely normal between episodes really makes this, as Charlie says, quite an easy diagnosis to make once you know what you're looking for. But I think the challenge may come when we see these children in the acute setting, in the middle of an attack, because that's when they look quite pale and unwell. And I can completely understand why these children end up getting every investigation under the sun and potentially might end up heading to theatre. So if you see one of these children who does look really unwell, just remember to have this diagnosis in the back of your mind. And if you focus again on the history, you may well end up saving them a lot of investigations and intervention. So I've really enjoyed this episode of Fontanelle. I hope you have too. If you have, please remember to subscribe, share with your friends, and leave a review on iTunes. If you have any suggestions, please let me know. I'm Caroline Story. You can email me at fontanellepod@gmail.com and I will get back to you. But for now, from Fontanelle, goodbye.